Well, I'm principally honored to be invited here. I esteem the Fields Institute very highly indeed. I think the Canadian people have done an enormous service to world mathematics by setting up this institute. I've spent happy times here. I like Toronto, and I'm just very happy to be here. I'm also very nervous that following the brilliant opening lecture of this morning, it's certainly a very different kind of mathematics I'm going to discuss, but again, let's try to interpret that as some kind of tribute to the variety of things that the Fields encourages. I thought it was reasonable for me to talk on some ideas in model theory which had developed in the ten years of the Fields' existence. Certainly my contributions to them were developed here, also at MSRI in Berkeley. Right. So this is model theory. But I'm going to try to keep it as palatable as possible for a general audience. I mean, long experience tells me that the moment I begin to mention a first-order formula, many of you will dive into your afternoon sleep. And so I will try, perhaps artificially, to avoid that. Okay, the Frobenius maps I'm going to talk about come in three forms, two very familiar in classical mathematics, and one a logic creation that was, I think, with some definite interest and significance for classical mathematics. So the original Frobenius maps arise as follows. You work in a characteristic P field. Q is a power of P, and you consider the map X goes to X to the Q. So this, because you're in characteristic P, respects addition and multiplication. If the field is perfect, there will be an automorphism. And of course, these maps are absolutely crucial in arithmetic. I mean, the Vey conjectures are essentially about these maps. These maps are important, combined with various cohomology theories, in counting points in finite fields and relating on varieties in finite fields, relating the number of points in these varieties to the topology of corresponding varieties in the complex topology. So this has been intensively studied and continues to be so. This is a characteristic P phenomenon which has no analog on the complex numbers. Okay. Then the logic creation is something which came to light in the last 10 years or so and is still being developed. This involves using logical techniques to transfer the Frobenius from characteristic P fields into characteristic zero, to give a meaning to the Frobenius, not to the Frobenius, but to various Frobenii, say, on the complex numbers. And this, I think, is at least strange, but it does, I think, lead to fairly palatable mathematics, which I'll try to explain later. And then there's another classical version of the Frobenius, which involves lifting the Frobenius from a specific finite characteristic into characteristic zero. That happens in rings of Witt vectors. So the Witt vectors are, say, complete valued domains, discretely valued. They will have as residue field some characteristic P field, perhaps a perfect one. That residue field will have a Frobenius. There is a device, ultimately due to Witt from the 1930s, for lifting that characteristic P Frobenius into some kind of characteristic zero Frobenius. But this is very specifically linked to things like the Witt vectors, to sort of unramified situations, and has nothing to do, prima facie, with the logic creation I mentioned in 2, transferring Frobenius in a different way. In 2, you let P tend to 0. You work through all the standard primes, go towards either 0 or infinity, and you create something. In this case, there's only one standard prime, and you lift. So these are different in principle, and they are different. Okay, so I have quite a few transparencies, and I fear that I will have to go at a canter or something even beyond a canter, let me do it. Let me do the cantering now with the early stuff, and then I'll trot along later. The older I get, the more difficult I find it to spell Lefshetz. I don't know what the explanation for that is. There must be some kind of neuronal explanation also, but I just don't know how many it takes to spell Lefshetz correctly, but I'm evidently missing one at the moment. The Lefshetz principle is a principle still used occasionally, but which is perhaps most well known from André Weil's book on Foundations of Algebraic Geometry. The principle being that something elementary, something really at the level of elementary statements about varieties or algebraic sets, if proved for the complex numbers, conceivably even by some topological method, must actually be true in non-topological situations for all algebraically closed fields of characteristic zero, and in fact must also be true for all algebraically closed fields of sufficiently large finite characteristics. That is just given as a principle, heuristic principle in Weil, and is occasionally still used. One sees it in some distinguished literature. This, of course, caught the attention of some of the early model theorists who wanted to give this a more precise meaning. Well, let me give you an example, a banal example, where Frobenius may be hidden. It's of course true in the complex numbers that every non-zero element has two distinct square roots. Right? That's of course true in all characteristics except two, but it fails at two. And you can elaborate this example to give things which fail infinitely many finite characteristics, etc., but not much more than that. In some sense, what I'm going to be doing is considering a Lefschetz principle where you take account of Frobenius. The Lefschetz principle is usually taken to go from the complexes into all the other characteristic zero fields, algebraically closed fields, and then into all but finitely many finite characteristics. But one can reverse it. One can go from infinitely many finite characteristics to characteristic zero. And I'm going to be doing something like this with the Frobenius, taking it from characteristic zero, taking sufficiently elementary statements about it, transferring them into taking it from characteristic P, transferring it to characteristic zero. All right. So this is my attempt to avoid this first order formula stuff. The question is, what exactly is the limitation, and what can be transferred from the complexes elsewhere? Of course, you can't transfer everything. For example, the complexes have got cardinality 2 to the hour 0. That's clearly not true for the algebraic numbers. Okay, but a trivial things like that is not an elementary statement. So let me just roughly delineate what I mean by elementary considerations here. Right? So suppose one is working with a category of, say, commutative rings with a 1. And you take a polynomial over the integers. Well, in any ring, the zero set of that polynomial makes sense. Okay, so and one can say it in a slightly fancier way by saying that such a polynomial gives rise to a covariant functor on a category of rings, okay, be it zero set. Now, elementary logic, or at least the elementary logic of fields, is concerned with starting with these functors and building certain others. Now, one thing you can do is to do Boolean operations on these zero sets. Okay. This will not yield you functors on the category of rings in general anymore. Because, for example, if I have a homomorphism of rings, it certainly doesn't necessarily send non-zero elements to non-zero elements. But if I'm working with fields, it does. So I can really go from the basic functor there to things built up by Boolean combinations. Let me just call them constructible for the moment. That would work for general fields. However, if I go to algebraically closed fields, an awful lot more is true. The essential point of algebraically closed fields is that you have the Hilbert-Nolstar invariants. That if you have an algebraically closed field, and you have, say, a variety over it, then it's got a point there. It's not just got a point somewhere else. It's got a point there. Anything that happens beyond the field can be pulled down into the field. In particular, you sort of respect projection of these functions. For example, suppose I take two variables and I say that x1 equals x2 squared. Okay? Or x1 minus x2 squared is 0. If I were to project, I would define the class of squares, and the class of squares is not respected even by field homomorphisms. It is by algebraically closed field homomorphisms. Okay? So I only want to use these considerations to give a sense to the Lefschetz principle. The Lefschetz principle is for algebraically closed fields. It's not true for fields. It's completely trivial to give examples in fields where things fail. Now, the essential point is that so what I've been trying to hint there is you start with some elementary functors like zero set functors, you take Boolean combinations, and then you start trying to project, take direct images of these. And these do define, because of the Hilbert-Milstein ansatz, functors for the category of algebraically closed fields. Now, you may think you will get new functors this way. And the basic theorem due to Chevrolet and Tarski in the 1930s is that you don't. In fact, all this business of quantifying is irrelevant. The only functors you get by the process I described are the Boolean combinations, the constructible things. Okay. All right. Now, the zero set functor was a thing from a field K producing a subset of K to the n. And then you do Boolean combinations in these and you get subsets of some K to the n. If you project, you may go into a lower n, K to the n. So the device for getting rid of syntax, first order formulas, is just to say that a sentence here is one of these functors with n equals 0. That's all a sentence is. And a formula is just one of these functors with n bigger than 0. And the Lefschetz principle basically says that the only sentences there are built up by combinations of statements about the characteristic of the field. These are the only functors there are here. Everything is a Boolean combination of statements about characteristics of the field. Okay. So that's just general nonsense. Now I want to describe the method whereby logicians can let, say, the primes go to infinity and create new objects. And then I'm going to describe various objects which have arisen, which look sort of far out, in a sense, but which have proved not to be so far out, in the sense that one can, A, understand them, and B, use them in conventional mathematics. Okay. So the algebra product construction was famously described by Mumford as being far out, in the Red Book of Varieties and Schemes. But it isn't really so far out at all. It's almost like a scheme. So you take an index set, a discrete index set, and now you look at the Stone-Check compactification of this. So this is the space of algebra filters over the index set. It's got a standard topology. This is compact. Now suppose I start with a family of, quotes, structures indexed by the original index set. Okay. Now these structures in our case will be fields, or perhaps fields with an extra structure, fields with an automorphism, something of this kind. And logic provides a means of making sense of extending the indexing to give a meaning to the, not merely to MI, where I is in the original family, but to MJ, where J is in the Stone-Check compactification. I want to describe this because it's a universal method for constructing exotic entities. All right, so the Stone-Check compactification is the space of algebra filters on the set. It's topologized in a conventional, essentially spectral way, by taking as basic open sets the algebra filters to which a given subset does not belong. Alright, so look, what have I got? I've got this topological space, inside it I've got the discrete space, over every point of the discrete space, I've got a structure. Right? I now want to put a structure over every point of the compactification. How does one do it? Well, you take a basic open set, you basically take a sheaf over the Stoneshite compactification. You take a basic open set, as I've described it up above, and you put over it a product of structures in the original indexing, provided this product makes sense. Okay? Well, a product of fields, for example, makes sense. It's just not a field. Right? Von Neumann regular rings. But it still makes sense. Okay? Now, this is a sheaf, and the question is, what are the stalks of it? Well, no, I mean, you might try to do this very categorically, you know, for some category which didn't have infinite products. I mean, that's all I'm thinking about. If we were working with conventional categories of models, you can make sense of any product. Right? But I would like to keep in the background the possibility of doing this in much more abstraction than I'm doing here. Now, there simply is a stalk there, okay, which we index by the ultrafilter. Okay? And it's very trivial to see that if you start with a principal ultrafilter, so corresponding to a point of the original space I, discrete space, then you only retrieve, you get back the fiber at I. The interesting things are what you get back at the non-principal ones. And they have to be thought of as sort of averages or limits of the MIs. Now, okay. Now, here are some elementary facts. That if the MIs are algebraically closed fields, so are these stalks. The thing we have is not, of course, what we attach over an open set is not a field, it's a von Neumann regular ring. But once we get back to the stalks, we have a field, and it's an algebraically closed field. Okay? If the original ones are algebraically closed. The characteristic of the stalk is P, where P is a finite prime, if and only if the set of points in the original indexing where the characteristic of MI is P belongs to the ultrafilter. So this point in the Stoneshite compactification has got a sort of dual status here. And the characteristic is zero if and only if, for every standard prime, the points where it's at, where MI has characteristic P, fails to belong to the ultrafilter. Now this is really the Lefschetz principle. This is really what the Lefschetz principle is saying. Modulo of the following fundamental theorem, which I'll put here maybe. You see, what's really going on here is some kind of continuity of satisfaction. I mean, I want to stress this. You really are doing something to make logic more topological. So you have the following theorem, due to Walsh in 1955, not quite stated in those terms. Okay, so this phi is a formula, but I think of it in the algebraic geometric case as a functor, say. But this is a theorem about totally general structures, not merely fields. So I take a formula that makes sense for the structures I'm dealing with. And now I want to see what happens sheaf theoretically. So I've got this formula that makes sense for the original MIs and for elements of the MIs, to say that points of the MIs satisfy that formula. And now I want to figure out what happens at the limit. And I want some kind of continuity of satisfaction. Okay? Suppose I take a point in the Stoneshite compactification, take an open set around it, and take sections over that open set. Okay. These sections will have germs at D, and D is just gone by shrinking down through the neighborhood. So I write square brackets for the sections. Then you have the following theorem. To decide if the germs satisfy the formula at the limit structure, you have to go back and look at the structures indexed by the discrete set and look at the places where those the function values satisfy the formula in MI. And this, you have satisfaction at the limit if and only if you have this kind of satisfaction modulo D. Now, this is an easy thing to prove. It's capable of lots of generalizations. It's easy to prove. But it's very suggestive in terms of creating and understanding exotic structures. And that's what I'm going to be talking about now, these exotic structures, which have ultimately to do with very serious algebraic geometry and number theory. So far, I would agree with anyone who thinks this is general nonsense, but it will soon cease to be. Okay, so here's a special case. This is usually the most suggestive case, but I want to keep the general case going. So I just take the standard primes. I is the set of standard primes on Z. And I take the fiber at P just to be the algebraic closure of FP. Right. Then for all the non-principal alpha filters, I get characteristic 0 for the limit. And in fact, in this particular case, the algebraically closed fields I get are all isomorphic to C, just on cardinality grounds. I want to stress it's not natural, not canonical, it's just on cardinality grounds. And this alone has an amusing use, which I always used to like. Axe, in the course of some work which I'm about to describe, rediscovered something which I think was buried in Grothendieck, roughly a principle that injective implies surjective for algebraic geometric maps of a fairly general kind. And he gave the proof by reducing it almost to the case of the algebraic closure of finite fields, where you prove it by counting. And I remember when I was at Yale, I once tried out on a very, very distinguished mathematician. I asked him to prove this over the complex numbers for me quickly. And he couldn't. Of course, it is easy to prove it quickly over the complex numbers by various topological arguments, but you can prove it trivially by going away from C into the finite characteristic cases and counting and coming back. Okay, so this already is not completely trivial. Okay, so now I want to go beyond this classical left shirt. And bring in this non-standard Frobenius and its various properties. So the first step was taken by Axe in 1968 in a long paper in the Annals of Math. Axe was trying to resolve a logical problem which went back to Tarski, I think in the 1930s, as to whether there was an algorithm for deciding, given a general sentence of field theory, whether it was true in all but finitely many finite fields. Now, for certain sentences, this is very easy. But the moment you start piling on the quantifiers, it's not so obvious how to do this, and it stayed open for a long time. It was known by kind of general nonsense principles that you would get a go at this problem if you could understand alpha products of finite fields. So the picture is the following. We go back now to this, we again take an index set, and this time the fibers are finite fields, but of unbounded cardinality, for example. What can I say about the limit structures which are created here? So over the non-standard, over the new points of the Stoneshek compactification, what can you say about them? And one had already one knew in logic that if you could say enough about them, you would get this algorithm. Not a useful algorithm, but the existence of an algorithm. Well, one thing you can say is that they are fields. That follows by this wash theorem, trivially. You can say they are perfect, That's because the original MIs are perfect, and again you can use the wash theorem. It's slightly less obvious. Another thing you can say is that the Galois group, the absolute Galois group of those fibers, is Z hat. And that means that every one of these fields has exactly one extension of each degree. Okay. And then finally, if MD happens to be infinite, it needn't be, but suppose it happens to be infinite, then it's very close to being algebraically closed. It's not algebraically closed because of what I just wrote down, the Galois group is too big. But it comes close to being algebraically closed. But every absolutely irreducible variety has a point. Okay, so this was already a slightly unexpected thing, that these limit structures, if you took a family of finite fields, were rather close to being algebraically closed. The only reason they weren't was that they had one algebraic extension of each dimension, exactly. Okay. Now, these fields had never been seen before, until Ax did this thing. But it was later, and maybe they've still not been seen, but they, at least by people out in the community, but we have seen them very often with our sort of strong medicine. Another interesting manifestation of these fields is the following. Suppose you take the absolute Galois group of Q, this unknown group, and you take at random, in the sense of the Haar measure in that group, an automorphism, an element of the group, and look at its fixed field, then it satisfies all these properties. And in a sense, it's a non-standard finite field. It's not, as a matter of fact, for separated reasons, one of the MDs, but it satisfies the same sentences as one of the MDs. And this has to do with Frobenius. All right. Okay, so let's try to orient ourselves about this. Ax only needed to know that the finite fields have one extension of dimension 2, one of dimension 3, one of dimension 4, etc. How it was proved didn't matter. Once you knew that, you could transfer the result by Walsh's theorem. But what is interesting is that the fact, the Galois theoretic fact for the MIs, for the finite fields, is proved by counting. I think that's the only proof essentially there is. Maybe one other proof. And they always use the Frobenius map. I mean, you show that you construct the extension of dimension n as a splitting field of an x to the q minus x. And then you do a counting argument. Counting makes no sense on the infinite fields, but the theorem transfers. So that the Galois fact is from something known for the finite fields for counting. The varieties fact, the fact that these fields are almost algebraically closed, comes from the Langevin estimates and isn't true for the finite fields. It's not true for the finite fields that every absolutely irreducible variety has a point. You can easily concoct examples using Frobenius. But what is true is that if you have a certain complexity of variety, the Langevin estimates enable you to get it to be true in sufficiently to have points in sufficiently large finite fields. Okay. So here's a deep mathematical fact used to get a property of this limit structure. Now, Ax had actually solved the problem he wanted to solve, because you can show that up to satisfying the same sentences, this is probably a slightly repulsive notion again to the average non-logician, up to satisfying the same sentences, the fields satisfying these conditions I wrote down are exactly the fields that come from this limit construction. Okay. I mean, there are fields satisfying these things which don't come from the limit construction, like the fixed field of an automorphism, as I just said, but they satisfy the same sentences. There's no way of distinguishing them in terms of the basic language of algebraic geometry. This uses the Tsvetaeva density theorem. So again, it's linked to a distinctly non-trivial theorem in number theory. All right, so now the Frobenius will come in shortly, but I want to bring in the Axe-Cochin-Yerschow theorem, which actually preceded Axe's work. This relates to another way in which logicians had done something interesting by letting a prime go towards infinity. All right, so till now I've considered two kinds of classical mathematical structure, I think both of fundamental importance, algebraically closed fields, like the complexes, or finite fields. Now, the next ones are also clearly of fundamental mathematical importance. Suppose now I work with the p-adic fields, with varying p. So I take the field of p-adic numbers, p is allowed to vary, and I take an I-index family of such fields. So all I insist is that at each I put on either, I put some qp, but the p may vary in some very erratic way. Okay? So I again apply this universal construction for getting these odd things, and I ask, what do I get? What structures are there at the limit? Okay, well, by Walsh, they satisfy Hensel's lemma. You can define the valuation algebraically using Hensel's lemma. The residue field is either a finite field, FP, or else is a characteristic zero pseudo-finite field, one of Axe's fields. So to understand these, you really need to understand, first of all, Axe's fields. And the value group is a so-called Pressburger group, which will be better known to, say, people like Steve Cook than probably to the geometers here. It's a certain kind of ordered abelian group which looks like the integers blown up. And again, there's a theorem, like Axe's theorem for the pseudo-finite case, that these properties I wrote down characterize the things you can get at the limit. Okay. This tends to be a fairly important logical activity, finding the axioms for some classical structure, up to satisfying the same sentences. Now, this particular thing had a striking use. Which I'll meet again at the end of my talk. There's a transfer principle involved here. So the QPs involved here are characteristic zero fields. Okay? Depending on the finite prime P, they have sort of cousins, power series fields over finite fields, which are characteristic P fields. Okay, so the addition and multiplication of these two things are very different. We tend to think of these things as like series in P, the elements of QP, where you carry, in sort of p-adic arithmetic, and these are power series in T, or Laurent series in T, and you add pointwise and multiply by simple carrying. Okay? Now, so I take this indexing I had. I had this indexing where over every point I had a qp. Suppose I erase it and put an fpt instead. Okay. And suppose I did it over the indexing just of the primes, P. Then the amazing thing is that you get always the same D's, and it doesn't matter which you start with, this or this, you always get the same D's for the residue field as characteristic zero, and the stocks you get for the two different sheaf constructions satisfy the same sentences. So you've made a characteristic P thing converge to a characteristic zero thing in a very different way from the Lefschetz principle. And in typical cases, although not always, the stocks are actually isomorphic for the two sheaves. Okay? Now, this was used instantly by Axe-Cochin-Yerschow to to give at least a partial and a fairly satisfying solution to a problem that Artin had raised as to the C2 property of the fields QP, something about forms and large numbers of variables, the details don't matter. It was known for the FPTs by work of Lang, and this transfer principle allowed you to obtain it almost always for the QPs in a sort of Lefschetzian version. You had to leave out certain primes for certain cases of the conjecture. So these were the classical things that people had done with letting P go to infinity. And now I want to bring in the Frobenius and see how it works. Okay, so the point is that I've described a general sort of sheaf construction in model theory. You start with a discrete indexing and some classical structures as the fibers, and then you create limits of these structures. So we did it for algebraically closed fields, for finite fields, for p-adic fields, or for power series over finite fields. Okay. Now we want to do it for the Frobenius map. We want to make P go to infinity in the Frobenius map and make it live somewhere interesting. Okay. So this time, my structure is the algebraic closure of a finite field. Okay. And it's equipped with some finite power of Frobenius. If you like, just the basic Frobenius, this doesn't matter, but a finite power is also adequate. So now we have a field with an automorphism. Okay. Then the theorem is the following. The basic fact, this is easy, this won't get you very far. You can create a limit of the automorphism. You create a limit of the fields, you get an MB, which will be an algebraically closed field, and simultaneously by Walsh you create a limit of the original automorphisms, and that'll be an automorphism of the limit. Moreover, its fixed field will be the limit of the fixed fields of the original thing in this topological sense. That's just Walsh's theorem. So this is a one-liner. But you get something very strange now. MD is a limit of algebraically closed fields. You get an automorphism of it, and you can easily prove that if the fixed field is infinite, then it's an ax field. It's a pseudo-finite field, one of these exotic fields. What makes this particularly interesting is that the MD, the algebraically closed field you get, can be the complex numbers. So you now create automorphisms of the complex numbers whose fixed field is one of axis fields. Okay? This would not be straightforward to do by bare hands. One might think that this is an accident. In fact, it's very far from an accident. So the question that I was working on when I was at the fields and earlier and later was, what kind of creatures are these automorphisms? They are automorphisms of algebraically closed fields. Their origins are in the finite fields, but they've got infinite fixed fields. Now, a certain insight that I had, I guess largely because I worked in the shadow of Abraham Robinson for a long time, was that these things should be sort of generic. There must be some kind of Hilbert-Nilstein-Satz true for them. There were some general reasons, motivations for thinking this. Okay. Let me just give some sense to what I mean by generic here. Okay. Let's first look at algebraically closed fields. I claim these are, in some definite sense, generic. This is because of the Hilbert-Nullstellensatz. In a sense, anything that happens beyond an algebraically closed field, if it's defined over the algebraically closed field, happens in the algebraically closed field. This is the Hilbert-Nullstellensatz. You can't suddenly pick up points on varieties that didn't have them before. Okay. In pseudo-finite fields, the things that Fish-Ax constructed, they turn out to be generic too, for a slightly different kind of algebraic geometry. you don't work with algebraically closed fields, you work with procyclic fields, that's to say fields which have at most one extension of each dimension, and you don't work with general embeddings of fields, you work with regular embeddings. So quite standard things from algebraic geometry. Then it turns out that pseudo-finite fields are exactly the elements of this category which have a null Spallanzani. And there's a model theoretic meaning to generic, which in some sense corresponds to having a null Spallanzani. So I was sort of prepared for these things to have a null Spallanzani. Largely because of some general nonsense work in model theory. Now, this... curious thing is that this work does relate a little bit to analysis, and I'm going to explain that in the next couple of transparencies. We've got we're working with a field with an automorphism. In particular, we're working with a field with an endomorphism that respects just the plus and the times. These things, I guess, first came up in the study of difference equations. So the shift map is an example of the shifting by one on a function. And there is a certain, there's quite an old tradition of studying the difference algebra. Jacobi confronted fairly serious questions about this. Okay. So there's a natural formalism for differential algebra. Okay, so it's ordinary commutative algebra equipped with a difference operator. The things we're creating there are examples of difference algebras. Okay? On the other hand, the ones most people are familiar with are those coming, say, from difference equations. Okay? Now, general nonsense in model theory tells you that this category must have things with a null Spallanzani. That's to say, there are objects there such that if you have a system of difference equations over that structure, solvable beyond it, it's solvable in it. This is completely general nonsense. So these things exist. There are generic or algebraically closed difference fields. Okay. So what I was led to guess was that the things created by Frobenius had this property. And I was really motivated by the fact I wrote down here about pseudo-finite fields being generic for the category of procyclic fields with regular embedding. So the task was, first of all, to find axioms for these general nonsense things. Algebraically closed fields, the existence of algebraically closed fields could have been predicted by this general nonsense, even if we never knew the complex numbers and we didn't know the fundamental theorem of algebra. One would have known that there were algebraically closed fields. The issue was to find axioms for them, useful axioms. So I succeeded in finding the axioms for these general nonsense or structures, the universal domains for difference algebra. Now, forget Frobenius for a moment. It doesn't enter here right now. This is general nonsense about difference equations. Here are the axioms. You have an algebraically closed field, you have an automorphism sigma, and you have the following property. If you take an algebraic variety, V, over your field, take its twist under sigma, or make sigma act on it, take the product variety, take a sub-variety of the product, with dominant projections to V and V sigma. So this is an algebraic geometric condition. Then the sub-variety meets the graph of Frobenius. Okay. Now, it's a theorem of Robinsonian type. That's to say, it's not very difficult, once one has had the idea, that these are the axioms for generic automorphisms. There's nothing else you can say about generic automorphisms apart from that. But there are two points to note. First of all, there are many such automorphisms of the complex numbers. They exist in profusion. Basically, they are dense. And secondly, if you look at these axioms, for the special case when V sigma is V, these axioms have the shape of things that one sees all the time in the proof of the Weil conjectures, or in the proof of the Riemann hypothesis for curves. They look just like it. So this leads one to think that there must be a connection between these generic things and the number theory. And this is what Khrushchevsky and I ultimately proved. We want to find axioms for the Frobenius. Remember when I'd done this for the limits of the finite fields, Axe had found the axioms. Axe and Kochan had found axioms for the limits of the chaotic fields. So our task was to find axioms for these limits of Frobenius. Okay. And we showed that the axioms are exactly the axioms we wrote down here for the generic case. Okay. Now this is I think this is, by any reasonable standards, very difficult. The Weil conjectures are used essentially in this proof. Without them, one would not be able to do anything. Now, just think what one has proved. We study difference equations. We look at the abstract algebra of difference equations, as Jacobi did, and you try to figure out questions about difference ideals and so on. He ran into troubles with this. Certain things he did, I think, are not accepted. A typical question you might have to answer would be, suppose somebody gives me 10 difference polynomials and another one. Is the 11th one in the difference ideal generated by the first one? How in God's name do you decide that? Well, this theorem says you can decide it by testing it against Frobenius and reducing it to a question of number theory, which certainly doesn't seem obvious a priori, that there should be any connection at all between them. And Khrushchevsky has a paper, I think it's not been published, but it's on his webpage, showing how there is an interaction between the issues that Jacobi was dealing with and the Weil conjectures. Now, I come finally to the Witt Frobenius. So this is a classical object, uncontaminated by logic, at least until we started working on it. So this entity was, I think it's fair to say, was discovered by Witt in a beautiful paper in 1937. And it's extremely general and essentially functorial. You start with a fixed prime P, standard prime P, and take a field of characteristic P, which let us say should be perfect. So that field has a Frobenius, conventional Frobenius on the first page of my lecture. What Witt did was to construct from this a characteristic zero domain, complete discretely valued domain, with residue field K, and with an automorphism, which when you reduce mod P, gives you the original geometric Frobenius. Now the existence of that is definitely not obvious for a general P. This is a beautiful piece of formal work. Short paper. Now, this is certainly, I think, a mainstream mathematical entity nowadays. I mean, this and superstructures occur in various aspects of cohomology and modern number theory. And what I wanted to do was to give an Kochan-Yershov analysis of this for a fixed prime, first of all. And I was to find the axioms for this creature. What is the geometry of this Witt Frobenius? I mean, what equations are satisfied? What difference equations are satisfied by the Witt Frobenius? Can one decide and can one characterize them? Now notice that any analysis of this thing must subsume the Kochan-Yershov thing, because suppose I take the case of the residue field to be the algebraic closure of a finite field with Frobenius, then the fixed field will be FP, and it's a general theorem that the Witts over little k are embedded in the width over big K, and the fixed field of the Frobenius on the big one is the width over the little one. That's a general theorem. The p-adics come out as the fixed structure of the width Frobenius. So you cannot possibly analyze the logic of this without subsuming X coach inertia. So this was the objective, to analyze, to find axioms for the width Frobenius. In terms of axioms for the Frobenius on the algebraic closure of the finite field. Well, this is just a restatement of what Axen, Kochan, and Yershov had done, basically. Their work was for fields with no automorphism, or for valuation rings without automorphism. They basically analyzed what they would call finitely ramified Henselian K. I don't need to define what finitely ramified means, but any number theorist will guess what this means here. You can analyze the model theory of these things in terms of the model theory of the residue field and the model theory of their value group. The value group is a Pressburger group, which is totally understood. The residue field may or may not be understood. It's a finite field. So what we proposed to do was to do the corresponding thing at the level of difference algebra, to understand the difference algebra of the width vectors in terms of the difference algebra of the residue field and trivialities about the value group. Okay. Now, this was undertaken by me, Luc Belair from Montreal, and Tom Scanlon from Berkeley. And we succeeded in doing this. We succeeded in extending the X coach and Yershov analysis to this classical Frobenius. And as we could decide, we could find axioms for this Frobenius on the algebraic, on width vectors over the algebraic closure of a finite field. Now, there are two consequences, one of them fairly routine, and the other one, I think, slightly startling. One is a little bit illusory. There is an algorithm for deciding any natural statement about Frobenius on those width vectors. It's not a good algorithm, but there's an algorithm. But more strikingly, I think, is the following. If you remember when I introduced the X-coach and Yershov thing, I described the sheaf, and you had it, to begin with, you had placed p-adic fields over the indexing, and you replaced them by power series fields. And the limits turned out to be the same, essentially the same. So, for a model theorist, it's irresistible to try to do the corresponding thing now in the width situation. Okay. And here's what it is, and it leads, I think, to an interesting result. To a Lefschetz principle for Frobenius on the width vector. So, I take the classically studied width vectors over an algebraically closed field, I take the classically studied width Frobenius. Okay. On the other hand, I go to the, say, the power series over the algebraic closure of a finite field. So it's a characteristic P entity. This one is characteristic 0, this is characteristic P. And I, by tensor product, I form an automorphism of this thing. What do I do? Well, on the powers of T, I take it to be the identity. And on the coefficients, I take it to be the conventional characteristic P Frobenius. Okay? It's a very different thing. It's got none of the complicated twisting that's involved in the width thing. So now I've got two structures. I've got the widths with this automorphism, I've got this power series ring with this automorphism. And I do the same game as I did before for X coach and Yershov. Take the set of primes and erect over it one of two things, the width situation or this very trivial Frobenius situation, the untwisted Frobenius situation. Then the theorem is that these two structures at the limits, at the genuine limits, satisfy the same sentences. So this is a Lefschetz principle. It says that if I have some property which is true, say, in most of the width situations, then it's true in most of the power series situations and vice versa. So I finish with one problem. This was suggested to, it was suggested to me that there might be something interesting here by Harder. I gave a lecture on this at Bonn, I think last year. See, there is something interesting here. This, if one is working with, say, groups, algebraic groups and so on, over the Witt vectors, this notion of conjugacy under the Witt-Frobenius turns out to be rather crucial. It seems to come up in the Langlands program and so on. Now, the fact is that any such question you can formulate about sigma conjugacy in these algebraic groups over the Witt vectors has an analogue for the algebraic groups over the power series field. And in the limit, the answers to these questions must be the same. Okay, thanks.